In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. A Lebanese cabinet minister was assassinated in Beirut today, the fifth anti-Syrian political figure killed in Lebanon in the past 2 years. The U.S. State Department is denouncing Pierre Jamail's assassination, calling it an attempt to intimidate the pro-Western government. Jamail, the country's minister of industry and son of a former Lebanese president, was shot and killed in his car in Beirut. He supported the anti-Syrian majority in the Lebanese parliament. We turn now to Rami Khoury. He's editor-at-large for the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut. And Rami, we spoke with you yesterday about a power struggle in Lebanon and what you called a new Cold War in the Middle East. With that in mind, what do you think today's events mean?
Well, I think the Cold War isn't always cold. It sometimes gets very violent, and I think this is an example of that. It's not, unfortunately, it's not unanticipated. I expected bombings and assassinations here and there in the process that's unfolding now, as you have serious political contestation taking place inside Lebanon, but actually representing wider forces, including the U.S. and Syria and Iran and the Europeans and Israel and others in the region. So this is a terrible tragedy and a crime, and you will get a heated internal political debate in Lebanon, but also probably stronger foreign international intervention, hopefully to mediate a resolution to the crisis.
This is the latest in a series of violent events since the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri last February. Now, the UN is investigating alleged Syrian involvement in Rafik Hariri's killing. Syria denies any role there. But today, Hariri's son did say that he thinks the hand of Syria is all over today's assassination. Tell me, how would Syria benefit here?
Well, the accusations against Syria are quick and expected and very widespread, and you're going to get a lot of people pointing at Syria and accusing it like this. And the general thinking goes that Syria wants to do two things. It wants to stop the international investigation that the UN is doing into the killing of Hariri, of Rafik Hariri, because the fingers are being pointed at Syria, and it wants to stop that process or dilute it as much as possible. And it also is accused of, Syria is accused of wanting to regain influence or control in Lebanon, and the critics of Syria are accusing it of killing these Lebanese off who are critics of Syria as a way to intimidate the political establishment and allow Syria to regain rule directly or indirectly through its allies. Now, these are accusations that have been consistently made against Syria since Rafik Hariri was killed almost 2 years ago, a year and three quarters ago, and the Syrians consistently deny it. So I think we have to wait for the UN investigation to come up with any evidence, and then we can judge better.
And what about Hezbollah here? What do you think happens now?
Hezbollah is pushing the Lebanese government politically very hard, and general sense among many Lebanese is that Hezbollah is so closely linked to Syria and Iran that it is actually doing their bidding. It denies that. It says it is working purely as a Lebanese group. But I think you're going to get heightened international mediation and intervention through the UN, hopefully, to try to resolve this issue and come to an agreement on the cabinet and the presidency in Lebanon, both of which are contested. So I think you're going to get intense mediation as well as continued stress within the country until you come to an agreement on how Lebanon should be governed, how power should be shared, and more importantly, the linkages between Lebanon and regional powers like Syria and Iran or foreign powers like the U.S. and France. That's what the battle's all about. What is the identity of Lebanon? What is its strategic orientation? And how should power be exercised?
You know, several journalists have been killed in Lebanon over the past year. Are you concerned, Rami?
No, I'm not concerned myself because I try to be careful not to accuse either party on both sides of this divide. I'm waiting for the evidence of the UN investigation, which I think is the right way to do this. I think people who engage in the battle journalistically are probably feeling a little bit more sensitive, obviously. My sense is that a journalist's job is, and a columnist's job is to analyze these situations and try to come up with a best and most accurate an analysis as we can to help us resolve these problems rather than to exacerbate them.
All right. Rami Khoury, editor-at-large for the Daily Star, Lebanon's largest English-language daily newspaper, is joining us on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you, Rami.
Thanks for having me.
There's scientific consensus that global warming is responsible for raising the Earth's temperature, melting glaciers, and shrinking ice caps. It's also been linked to extreme weather and threats to biodiversity. And some scientists are now saying there is more trouble beneath the surface. They say there's mounting evidence that carbon emissions are being absorbed into the oceans and altering their chemical composition, making them more acidic and adversely affecting marine life. In the current issue of The New Yorker magazine, Elizabeth Colbert draws together the work of a number of researchers in her article, The Darkening Seas, What Carbon Emissions Are Doing to the Ocean. And she joins us on the line. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon.
Well, let's start with a little bit of science here first, because sometimes this is a little bit complicated. But basically, can you explain what happens when we have the ocean and the air coming together?
Right. Well, what happens is that there's always an exchange of gases between the ocean and the atmosphere until the two basically reach a kind of an equilibrium with each other. And if you're not changing the atmosphere or you're not changing the ocean, then they will equilibrate, you know, in a matter roughly of about a year with the surface ocean, but much, much longer with the deep ocean. But since we're pumping CO2 into the air constantly by burning fossil fuels, we're changing the composition of the air, and that has to re-equilibrate with the sea, and a lot of that CO2 is ending up in the oceans.
So basically what's happening is the ocean is absorbing a lot of the CO2.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what happens. It's basically dissolving in the oceans, and there have been massive studies done to determine exactly how much of the CO2 we've put into the air has ended up in the oceans, and the conclusions that people have reached, and they're pretty robust conclusions, is that roughly half of the CO2 that humans have put into the air since the start of the Industrial Revolution is now dissolved in the oceans.
Okay, and obviously the next question is, what happens to the ocean when all that CO2 is absorbed into it?
Right. Well, CO2, when it dissolves in water, forms an acid called carbonic acid. It's a pretty weak acid, and we drink it all the time when we drink carbonated beverages. But if you add enough to the oceans, as we've done, it changes the pH of the oceans, the acidity of the oceans. So the oceans are becoming more and more acidic.
And what does this acidification do, basically? Why is it bad?
One of the most obvious ways that it's bad is that organisms that form shells, and there are literally, you know, thousands of different species that form shells, and we're talking about everything from barnacles and clams and things like that to these tiny little microorganisms that you can't even see that form shells. And we're also talking about corals that form skeletons out of what's called calcium carbonate, so basically chalk. And if you imagine it, you think when you throw a piece of chalk into a bowl of vinegar, you can imagine that it would start to dissolve. And while the water isn't becoming that acidic, it is basically making it harder and harder for these organisms to form their shells or their skeletons. And there's a good deal of evidence coming in now that organisms that do form shells or skeletons out of calcium carbonate are having a harder and harder time doing that.
Hmm. You tell the story, when you talk about marine life being affected, you tell the story of Victoria Fabry, who's an oceanographer at California State University at San Marcos, and how she found out, really, inadvertently, about the effects of increased carbon dioxide. Can you explain her experiments and what she determined?
Yeah, that was a fascinating story. Right. She went out in the 80s, you know, sort of before people were thinking about a lot of these issues, and she collected some organisms called pteropods, which are basically snails, sort of marine snails, little tiny creatures. And she was measuring their shell growth just for her PhD. And she one day found a whole lot of them, a slew of them up in the Arctic. And she put them in these bottles. She had found so many of them that she put too many in a bottle. And when these guys breathe, just like, you know, human beings, they give up CO2. So the CO2 started to build up in the bottles. And when she came back the next day, she saw that they were starting to dissolve themselves, that their shells were starting to dissolve. And that was a result of the CO2 having built up in these bottles. And she did begin to think to herself, wow, that's interesting. That shows that these creatures are sensitive to this kind of change. But what people didn't really realize at the time, and as I said, this was in the mid-80s, was that we were having this massive effect on the oceans ourselves, and that the oceans were starting to look like the water inside those bottles.
Right, right. I also read the story of Chris Langdon, who was actually working at the site of the Biosphere 2 project, and what happened there. Can you explain that experiment as well?
Sure, that's a fascinating story. the Biosphere 2, as people may recall, was this attempt to build a totally self-enclosed world out in the Arizona desert. And what happened, and the reason the project was sort of considered a failure, was because they couldn't control their atmosphere, and oxygen levels dropped and CO2 levels went way up. And then the project collapsed, and Columbia took it over, and this marine scientist who was then at Columbia, Clarice Langdon, went out to figure out something to do with this. They had this huge tank. They had several sort of ecosystems, mini ecosystems, and one was an ocean where they raised different kinds of coral, among other things. And when he got there, he found, which isn't surprising given what we've talked about, that the pH of this ocean was very low because the CO2 levels in the air had been so high. And he tried to bring the pH levels back up. And every time he did that, so he poured chemicals that had were supposed to have the effect of bringing the pH back up. But every time he did that, he found that it would fall again and that the rate that it fell was proportionate to the amount of chemicals he'd added to the water. And he started to think, well, maybe what's happening is he was stimulating the growth of the coral in the tank, and they were taking up these chemicals. And that was a controversial thesis at the time for complicated reasons that I won't go into right now. But anyway, he received a lot of sort of pushback for that. But over many years, he did these very, very careful experiments there. And he did prove that corals are very sensitive to changes in the pH of the water.
So corals and pteropods, these little snail-like creatures. But what about other more prominent, if you will, marine creatures? Have we seen an effect on those types of creatures of the sea?
Well, I do want to say that you almost can't have a creature that's more prominent than coral. Coral reefs are amazing places, and they support there are estimates between 1 million and 9 million species, okay? And it is also estimated that a quarter of all marine fish spend at least part of their life, you know, around a reef. So we were talking about a very, very, it's not one species of coral, it's many species of coral, but coral are extremely important. Then there are also experiments have been done on these tiny little organisms called coccolithophores, which are microscopic little organisms that form these tiny little plates, basically, that they arrange around themselves. You can't even see them, but they're quite beautiful under a microscope. And they form these huge blooms that cover thousands and thousands of square miles. And they're at the very bottom of the marine food chain. So they are also being affected by changes in ocean pH. So it really spans, you know, the gamut from the very bottom of the food chain. Now, I don't think very many experiments have been done on the very top of the food chain, but you can imagine, you know, if the bottom of the food chain falls out, that has huge ripple effects. And that is what many marine scientists are worried about.
We're talking with New Yorker magazine writer Elizabeth Colbert about her article, The Darkening Sea, What Carbon Emissions Are Doing to the Ocean. We'll be back in just a minute to hear about some of the best and worst case scenarios that scientists have mapped out for the future of our oceans if the acidification process continues unchecked. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Here and now. We're back with the New Yorker magazine's Elizabeth Colbert talking about her reporting on ocean acidification. That is the changing chemical composition of the sea because of the absorption of carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels. And Elizabeth, one of the researchers you interviewed is Ken Caldera. He's what they call a climate modeler, a scientific sort of crystal baller, if you will, and he's at Stanford University. Caldera's come up with four scenarios, you say, for ocean acidification, based on various levels of economic growth fueled as it is now by oil and coal. And he told you that even a best case scenario is really a worst case scenario. Can you explain what he found and what he told Congress about this? Because we're all thinking, okay, problem's been identified, so what's going to be done, I think, is the next question here.
What Ken did was he took these scenarios, and they're pretty well-developed scenarios, and they're used by climate modelers just to sort of look out into the future, and they're, you know, everyone sort of has agreed what they are, and they're known by these shorthands, and ordinary people certainly, you know, can't even understand what these guys are talking about. But anyway, he ran these scenarios through these models of ocean uptake of CO2, and what he found was that the difference between, you know, a best case scenario, that is we really all get together and we really try to cut down our CO2 emissions, or in a worst case scenario, we don't do anything and CO2 emissions, you know, just continue to grow at the rate that they're growing now, perhaps even faster. For marine life, the difference was not that great. And what he found and what other people have also found is that if you keep going on any of these trajectories, by the end of this century, so by the year 2100, you start getting conditions around the poles, because in cold water, these effects tend to show up faster for reasons having to do with the way temperature interacts with CO2. You start getting water that is corrosive to shells. So while people wouldn't say, okay, it's impossible that we'll have shell-forming organisms there, your sort of first guess would be it will be very difficult for shell-forming organisms to function in those waters. And that is a pretty serious change in the world. And as I mentioned before, some of those organisms, like pteropods, things that, you know, people have, you know, barely even heard of, they're at the bottom of the food chain for species that we have heard of, like salmon. So, you know, that can have these huge effects that just, you know, radiate out through the oceans.
And when he told members of Congress about these scenarios, what happened? Ken Caldera,
well,
we're talking
right,
about.
Mm-hmm. Right. He went in to give a congressional briefing, and people said, okay, well, what would be a good level of CO2 in the air? Where could we sort of, you know, stabilize CO2 emissions in the air? And he said, I don't think we should think about that. We should think about, you know, what level, what kind of CO2 emissions do we want? And they said, okay, what kind of CO2 emissions do we want? And he said, none. We really should be emitting no CO2. And I think his quote was, you know, when you talk about mugging little old ladies, you don't say, what's a good rate for mugging little old ladies? You say, mugging little old ladies, you know, is a bad thing, and we should really cut it out. And that was his message.
Right. If some scientists are saying that we should have no CO2 emissions, but at the latest round of international climate change talks in Kenya, delegates made no commitments to cut greenhouse gases, pass the current Kyoto Treaty, which expires in 6 years, and developing nations, including China, India, and Brazil, will continue without mandatory caps on emissions, will basically produce more carbon, which winds up in the ocean. So what are the predictions about the future and the best way to deal with this?
Well, I think there's two ways to sort of answer that question. And one is very depressing. I mean, you look at the action on the world front and you realize, you know, that the goal should be zero, as Ken Caldera put it, and that we're so far away from that, you know, that it's, you know, not even on the table. And another way to look at it is, you know, you have to set an extremely ambitious goal, and that more and more people are waking up to that, that these things are very, very hard to do. We're really talking about a challenge of an unprecedented scale. I don't want to minimize any of the challenge, but that the alternatives, which are, you know, an ocean that looks totally different, a world that looks completely different from the one that we know now, if people realize those are the alternatives, then, you know, the effort may start to seem worthwhile.
Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her article, The Darkening Sea, What Carbon Emissions Are Doing to the Ocean, appears in the current edition of the magazine. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Well, we'd like to take a few moments to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air a few of your thoughts. And we heard from many of you following a recent story we did about trends in addressing the problems of whom we call the homeless. Joel Glenwickson of Massachusetts, who has worked on homelessness and poverty issues for 18 years, took us to task for our terminology.
I prefer you talking about people who are homeless as opposed to the homeless. People who are homeless suggests that this is a varied group of people whose reasons for homelessness are as different as they are and as different as we are. And when you say the homeless, it seems to indicate that this is one homogeneous group, which it's not.
Well, we'll be doing more pieces regarding homelessness in the coming months. Jackie from Scottsdale, Arizona, called to remind us to cover the full spectrum.
Through financial situations and losing of a position, I was forced into an eviction situation, and it all became a horrible rolling ball that made me understand how it's possible for an ordinary middle-class person to end up as a homeless person on the street.
And finally, this musical note, Judith Carlin of Wellesley, Massachusetts, wanted to know what we played following our piece on the 50th anniversary of the Hungarian Revolution. Well, Judith, it was the slow movement of Béla Bartók's Concerto for Viola and Orchestra. Here's a little more. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now.
It's Here and Now. This being Thanksgiving week, food is on the minds of many of us. And we have a question. How many food-related decisions do you make each day? 10, 20, 100? Try 200, according to Cornell University researcher Brian Wansink, who says that when we're not thinking about it, we eat quite a bit. He also says that if people could control some of their food decision-making, they could forget about counting calories, carbs, and trans fats. Professor Wansink shares his findings in a new book titled Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. And he joins us now. Brian, welcome.
That's great to be there. Thank you.
Can you explain, first of all, how you found that many folks are not completely aware of how much they're eating, and can you say why generally you think that is?
We have way too many things going on in our life to kind of go over the nuances of how many ounces we're pouring or how many bites of macaroni we've had that day. So we've got the distractions of who we're eating with, we've got the distractions of what's going on, whether it be the television set or something we're reading. We also have all the distractions of what we're thinking about all day. And as a result, these 200-plus decisions that we make a day end up being very subtly but very significantly influenced by the little cues around us.
And you also talk about something in the book called the mindless margin. Can you explain that?
The mindless margin is the number of calories that's estimated a typical person can cut out of their day-to-day intake without knowing it psychologically and certainly without knowing it physiologically. And it's estimated that this can be, for most people, at least 300 calories. 300 calories a day doesn't sound like a whole lot, but over the course of a year, if you were to eliminate 200 or 300 calories per day, you'd weigh 20 to 30 pounds less in a year than you otherwise would today. And a lot of these small changes that need to be made are things, small tweaks that we can do to our own environment, changing the size and shape of bowls, changing the proximity of things, changing the mix of foods you put on the table, changing where we locate them on the table. There are a legion of small 100-calorie changes that we can make that can trim away that 300-calorie mindless margin, leaving us to lose weight at the end of the year instead of saying, man, you know, why are my pants even tighter than they were last year?
You also say we have a lot of external cues telling us to eat.
Yeah, well largely, we eat a lot when we're not really convinced that we're even hungry. We did a study, well, if you talk to most people say that they overeat because they're either really, really hungry or the food's really, really good. We decided to say, hey, look, let's say we take people who are full and give them food that is terrible. And one thing we did is we took people who had just finished eating lunch and they were coming in to see a movie. We gave them either a medium bucket of popcorn or a huge, large bucket of popcorn, but this was five-day-old stale popcorn.
Yuck.
But what we did, we gave them this popcorn, and they, you know, they take a bite, and they just wince because the stuff was terrible. But what we found is that over the course of the movie, people who were given this huge bucket ended up eating 35% more popcorn than those given medium buckets.
And they were full.
Yeah, they were full, and the food was terrible because every cue around you in the movie says, eat, eat, eat. The people next to you, when they crunch away, they say eat. When you watch the movie, a big part of the script is eating popcorn as you're looking up at the screen. And then the size of the container actually suggests how much to eat.
You know, you had another really interesting experiment about a soup bowl. Can you briefly explain the soup bowl?
Well, this is also Most people say, if you ask them, hey, how do you know your meal's done? They say, hey, well, I know I'm done when, hey, my plate's clean. Or, you know, my soup bowl's empty, then I'm done. We thought, oh, well, what happens if the plate never empties or the soup bowl never empties? And so we created this bottomless soup bowl where we actually drilled a hole in the bottom of the soup bowl and through the bottom of the table and ran this food-grade tubing up, connected to the bottom of the soup bowl, over in this big six-quart cauldron of hot soup. And what happened, we invited people in for lunch, and as they ate soup, the level would drop down in the soup bowl, but it would always be refilled to the point where it was at about half full. So after about 20 minutes, we stopped people, and one of the things we found is that they ended up eating 73% more soup in these refilled soup bowls. But when we asked them how full they were, they didn't rate themselves as being any more full than the people eating from normal bowls because there was still half a bowl of soup left.
That's
how can it be full?
So we're really not as smart as we think we are. But, you know, what else I thought was interesting in these experiments is that the folks that you spoke with thought that other people would eat like this and have to finish their soup bowl, but not them.
But, you know, what goes on is we all want to think that we are way too smart to be fooled by this. So even when we show people evidence, they say, well, come on, others might get fooled by this, but not me. And this is what makes this so incredibly dangerous. First of all, these cues are ubiquitous. But second of all, we don't think they're having any impact, which allows them to continue to have the impact that they've had every 2 pounds every year that we've gained over the last 20 years.
Right. And actually, in one instance, you gave a course to students about mindless eating.
Yes.
You told them about the cues, right? And then you tested your experiments, and they still fell for the cues and ate more than they should have.
Yeah. I did a 90-minute lecture of graduate students. I showed them how if they eat Chex Mix out of a big bowl, they're going to eat more and why. And I demonstrated it. They discussed it. I showed them videos. I lectured on it. And yeah, they were sick of it. And what we ended up finding was that when we, 6 weeks later, invited them to a Super Bowl party, either served out of a big bowl of Chex Mix or two smaller bowls of Chex Mix, and even though they knew about this, they ended up eating 53% more.
Right. How much of this might be explained just by the sort of old-fashioned notion that we had to clean our plates?
Well, I mean, I think some people believe so. I think what instead is going on for us is that when we decide how much we want to eat, we estimate how much we're going to eat, and we serve it to ourselves. Instead of taking a bite and saying, am I full yet? Am I full yet? And I think it has less to do with the clean plate club than it does the idea that we're our own best estimator of how hungry we think we are, and we don't want to spend our entire meal obsessing about whether we're full or not.
Yeah. I know that this is a time of year that a lot of people just eat mindlessly. Obviously, it's the holidays, and we're not thinking, and we're getting together with folks. But I'm wondering, as a food researcher, Brian, do you find yourself mindlessly eating sometimes, especially this time of year? Or have you just done this so much that you're above it all?
Well, everybody mindlessly eats, and if there's any day that you're going to allow yourself to mindlessly eat, it's on these very special holidays that we have. But even for Thanksgiving, for instance, there's some very easy things you can do. And one thing is, you know that you're going to really disappoint a lot of people if you don't eat Aunt Grace's green bean casserole or your grandmother's famous turkey recipe. You know you're going to have to eat all those things. So the key thing to do is just beforehand, don't eat the cheese ball. You know what cheese balls taste like. Just wait for the dinner to start, and that way you can end up going through the entire thing.
Brian Wansink, director of the Cornell Food and Brand Lab. His new book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. Brian, thanks.
Thank you very much.
And still to come, Garrison Keillor remembering the late Robert Altman. You're listening to Here and Now. Film director Robert Altman has died. The man who directed MASH, Nashville, and A Prairie Home Companion died Monday. He was 81 years old. Altman won an honorary Oscar last year for lifetime achievement. At the ceremony, he revealed he had a heart transplant 10 years ago. Altman had one of the most distinctive styles in film, often using long tracking shots to move among huge casts, encouraging improvisation and overlapping dialogue. He was also known for his distinctive voice, anti-establishment, anti-Hollywood, and it was exemplified by the 1970 anti-war black comedy MASH that featured the escapades of military doctors and nurses.
I wonder how a degenerated person like that could have reached a position of responsibility in the Army Medical Corps.
He was drafted.
Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come.
His will be done.
Oh, Fred, my lips are hot.
Robert Altman's last film was A Prairie Home Companion, a film adaptation of the public radio show of that name. And joining us to talk about Robert Altman's legacy is Garrison Keillor, host and creator of A Prairie Home Companion, the radio show. And Garrison Keillor, a sad day. What does the passing of Robert Altman mean to you?
Well, I admire him so much, and I admire his passing, which seems so much in keeping with his life. He said so many times when people inquired about his health that he wanted to go out working. He didn't want to go sit in a room looking out a window. And that's exactly how he went. He was at work on a new picture. He was excited by it. I saw him a week ago in New York, and he was talking about it. It's called Hands on a Hard Body. And he was, struggling through the script process. He was a man who just absolutely loved what he did, and to be still doing what you love doing when you're 81 is a model for the rest of us.
Right. You were the star of A Prairie Home Companion, and that must have been really interesting, adapting your creation with Altman's creative process here. How would you describe working with him on that film?
He was really a joy to work with. He didn't care for meetings at all. He was not an organized sort of a person. He just liked to be kept apprised of how you were doing. So you could just kind of talk to him on the phone every so often, and he'd say, yeah, that sounds good. I think you've got something there. That sounds good. I wouldn't worry too much about that. And so writing the screenplay was fairly painless. Then we came up to the shooting, and he was the emperor of shooting the picture, didn't need any of my help, and I just stood off to the side and watched. He seemed like an old man before he started shooting, and once it all began, he really was in his prime. Even though he was moving slowly and carefully, he was loving every minute of it. He loved the whole thing. He loved the chaos of the shooting, and he loved the editing room and sitting in there and moving the chess pieces, and then more than anything else, he loved to sit and screen the picture with some friends or with people around. He just never got tired of sitting in a dark room looking up at it.
Actress Meryl Streep, who was also in the film, she described both you and Robert Altman as depressed optimists. And she also said the film, which is about death, was something that made her realize that Altman was not afraid of death. What do you think of her comments?
Well, I think that's true. He was not afraid. He and I talked once about making a picture about a man coming back to Lake Wobegon for the funeral of his father. And Mr. Altman just said out of the blue, he said, "The death of an old man is not a tragedy." I thought it was such a great line. I wound up using it in the movie that we did make. And I think about that now that he's passed. The death of an old man is not a tragedy, especially not when he goes out with such style and such grace.
Garrison Keillor, author and host of the public radio program A Prairie Home Companion, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Garrison Keillor helped us remember film director Robert Altman, who's died at the age of 81. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Here and Now. Are you feeling a little anxious as Thursday approaches? Do you agonize about the turkey, to brine or not to brine? Does the question of whether your cranberry sauce will set keep you awake at night? Well, today we're re-airing one of our favorite food pieces. Here and Now's Rachel Gopram, we discovered, was worrying about cranberry sauce. So we sent her to talk turkey and more with Chris Kimball. He's founder of Cooks Illustrated magazine and host of the PBS program America's Test Kitchen.
You are now standing in front of the double doors leading into our 2,500-foot test kitchen.
Well, why don't we start cooking and all sorts of things that we're doing today?
I think we're going to do a taste test right off the bat with a fresh bird, a high-quality fresh bird, against a frozen butterball.
Okay.
Frozen butterballs are injected with a flavored solution, a brine solution. And we took a fresh bird from a good quality producer and brined it ourselves and just roasted that off just to see the difference between a local fresh bird and a national frozen brand.
So, but is this the butterball here or is this the brined as well? Same.
Can't tell you.
Oh, because they look alike. They look alike, don't they? Oh, boy. Now I feel vulnerable because I don't know. Well, they certainly look different. I have a sense of which one is which.
One of whom you can see has a fairly dense texture and mm-hmm. is very white.
Mm-hmm.
And the other breast meat is actually a little bit darker and grayer. Do you want to take a taste here?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Okay. All right, let's try that. Very, very different. The fresh turkey has a lot of flavors. The other one sort of tastes like paper to me.
And also looks like it's made out of some plastic-based substance because it doesn't look like it has much texture. And as you said, the locally grown one,
right.
is much coarser, it's chewier, it's probably a little drier, maybe,
right.
but it actually has flavor.
So basically, you're recommending to folks, go for the fresh turkey.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people don't mind bland, tender, wet turkey. That's what
right.
they grew up with. So it's up to you. But we prefer a chewier, more flavorful meat. Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about brining. Why did you brine? Do you always brine?
Well, a frozen butterball or a kosher bird has the equivalent of brining. It's injected, it's salted, whatever. So you would not need to brine a frozen butterball. If you bought a locally fresh bird or any fresh bird, that's not brined usually. And brining means soaking in a salted water solution. So it just means that it's going to give you juicier meat, and you're much less likely to get dry, overcooked breast meat.
Okay, great. Let's check out this brining process here. Tell me what we have.
We have 2 gallons, 8 quarts of water, and we use a big plastic container. So the basic formula is 1 cup of table salt per gallon. We have 2 gallons. We have 2 cups of table salt.
And that's for the average size turkey?
Yeah, that'll definitely handle a turkey. And you're going to want to do this for about 8 hours for a 12 to 14-pound bird.
So, first of all, what temperature is our water? And you're stirring it here with a whisker.
Yeah, the key is to keep the bird under 40 degrees. And so, therefore, this would have to go in a refrigerator. Or you could use, I have a beer chest right over here, which you could use that as well.
Okay, but basically, you just poured the salt right in the water here. Okay.
This is we've rinsed this bird out, taken the giblets out, and we're going to put that down. Here she goes in the water to cover, and that'll sit again a 12 to 14-pound bird will sit about 8 hours. You can do it overnight, and be sure you rinse it off thoroughly when it comes out.
Let's talk about your philosophy of stuffing because I know you have one.
The problem with stuffing, there's a big ball of it here, is when you stuff a bird with cold or room temperature stuffing, it takes longer for the stuffing to come up to 160 than it does for the white meat, the breast meat, to hit 165. So you end up overcooking the breast meat because you want the stuffing to be safe. There is a way around this, which is you can take the stuffing, throw it in a microwave, and then stuff the turkey so that you get a head start to the stuffing.
So what do we have in front of us here?
When we developed a recipe 6 or 7 years ago for cranberry sauce, we found that there's a recipe on the back of the raw cranberry bag. And it was perfect, except we added 1/4 teaspoon of salt. It's very simple to make, and it's a lot better than what you buy in the supermarket. So this is going to be a little test of that.
So basically, what you're saying is people do not need to be intimidated. by cranberry sauce. You can make the cranberry sauce. And we are looking here at the difference between what you've made and what?
And a store-bought version. You're just taking sugar, water, salt, cranberries, essentially, and cooking them on top of the stove for 10 or 15 minutes and then taking it off the stove and letting it sit. I mean, that's about it. And the recipe's on the back of those bags of whole raw cranberries.
If you want to get a little creative with it, what do you recommend?
You could certainly add a little bit of orange zest to it if you wanted. You could certainly, at the end, add some nuts, you know, toasted nuts to it if you wanted. I mean, for me, on Turkey Day, being creative is not a good thing. That's a really bad thing.
All right, well, let's try that.
You will tell a difference here. Yeah, taste that one now. This is the one that's...
Yeah, this is gloppy.
You can tell.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any cranberries in there.
No. It's a red jelly substance. Mm. That's one of the great secrets of Thanksgiving is the cranberry sauce is anybody, my 7-year-old, can make it.
You've changed my life on the cranberry sauce. You have changed my life. Now I am not freaked out and I can do it. So where are we next? Are we going to talk potatoes?
Mm-hmm. First of all, for making mashed potatoes, we use Yukon Golds. They have a lot of flavor. You can use russets. The thing we do differently, two things, is we boil them in their skin, and that keeps the water out, so it keeps a nice, light, fluffy mashed potato. And then we peel them when they're still warm. You can stick a fork into them and use a paring knife to peel them. The peel comes off easily. And then we mash them, 2 pounds of potatoes, with a stick, 1 stick, 8 tablespoons of melted butter.
Ooh, and that, daddy-o.
Well, we're not finished with the cream in half and half yet. We're getting started. And that coats the starch in the potatoes, so you don't get that gluey texture. It gets nice, light texture. Then we'll add the warm half and half to it after that.
So now we're going to see if the turkey is done and how that is done. Now, how long has this baby been cooking?
Do 45 minutes at 400 degrees, breast side down. Mm-hmm. Then we flip it and reduce the temperature to 325. And for a 12 to 14-pound bird, that's another 50 to 60 minutes. So it would be an hour and a half to hour and 45 minutes, roughly speaking. The two places you want to look at, first, obviously, is in the breast. And you want to make sure you get in the center of the breast. This is a ThermoPen digital thermometer. So you're trying to get it in the middle. And I'll put it in horizontally in the breast, meat like that. And it says 151, 152. That's not good enough. We'll try the other side. Now, this is interesting. This one's got a different reading. We're looking at 172, 171, 170, 169. So you'll find sometimes that one side will be cooking quicker than the other side.
So what do you do?
I would now, if I were to do this, I'm going to do this. I'm going to turn this around in the oven and flip it around. The next thing you want to do is the inside of the thigh. The thigh, you really want to be looking for 170 to 175, and the breast meat, 165.
Okay.
So you need about 10 more degrees. So we're going to turn this around in the oven, put it back in, and let it finish up.
Well, thank you very much for enlightening me and our listeners. And these have been very good tips. I now know I can go home and make some cranberries and not have an anxiety attack. So I appreciate that.
So go roast a big one and do a good job, right?
All right. Thank you.
That's Rachel Gottbaum talking with Chris Kimball of America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Illustrated Magazine. Tomorrow, Chris explains pie crusts for us. For recipes, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.